certain issues. Mr. Poole, you may. The Pauley case, as a result of Mr. Poole's application for re-argument limited to certain issues. Mr. Poole, you may proceed.
Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the court, I'm Richard Poole, counsel for plaintiff Jason Pauley and the other members of the Pauley family. If it pleases the court, I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. I will start with the emergency vehicle statute, then address London Fog, and conclude briefly with respect to Trooper Reynolds' gross negligence. In looking back over the briefing and the prior oral arguments, appellant's counsel regrets that perhaps we were not as articulate as we would have liked. And before the court opened this session, I handed up to your honors a single sheet that has the entire emergency vehicle statute, section 4106, because in the code it just so happens that subsection D carries over from one page to another, and subsection E is on the second page. This morning, Your Honors, I would like to start actually with subsection E, which perhaps has not received the attention it deserved. It is essentially unchanged in pertinent parts since it was enacted in 1963 with 54 Laws, Chapter 160. And as Your Honors can see, the pertinent parts of subsection E are authorized emergency vehicles within the meaning of this chapter mean police vehicles, and going down to the end, and emergency vehicles of state, federal, county, or municipal departments, and so forth. So emergency vehicles, authorized emergency vehicles, is a defined term in the emergency vehicle statute. And the court, in an advisory opinion, in re request of Governor 722A2-307 at 310 in 1998, indicated that a department is part of the executive branch of government and is not a political subdivision or an agency of the state. It's actually part of the state. So here we have the state and the Department of Public Safety as well as the Division of State Police. There's no dispute here at all that the collision involved an authorized emergency vehicle, Superior Court opinion at page 11 so indicates, and that it was owned by the state. In the June argument last year, Mr. Seitz indicated at the transcript 22 that this vehicle was in fact indeed owned by the state. So we have to look at E in order to understand subsection D, which is what I'll now turn to. And of course there, the operative sentence is the carryover between page 589 and 590 of the code. The owner, here the state, of such emergency vehicle defined as including the state may not assert the defense of governmental immunity in any action. This is a very narrow immunity waiver. It applies just in the specific circumstances of emergency responses. Appellants submit that there can be no reasonable doubt that the emergency vehicle statute is an unlimited waiver of the state's immunity, and I say that this morning for two reasons. First, it's clear that the emergency vehicle statute contemplates a suit or an action, as it states, against the state, and that the defense, again contemplating a lawsuit, of governmental immunity may not be asserted. The Constitution, of course, is the starting point, Article 1, Section 9 of the Delaware Constitution. It does not specify any magic words for the waiver of the state's immunity. It says suits may be brought against the state according to such regulations as shall be made by law. The Delaware case law is clear that where a statute provides that the state may be sued, that in and of itself is a waiver of immunity, unless, for instance, a statute such as the County and Municipal Claims Act in Section 4011A says specifically that the fact that the state can be sued, or in that case the county can be sued, does not constitute a waiver. And this court in the Sant case, S-A-N-D-T, made clear that the if in the absence of such a proviso, that the state being able to be sued is not a waiver. There is a waiver. And other cases say the same thing. Mastin, Department of Community Affairs versus M. Davis, and Wilmington Housing Authority versus Williamson. So then we come to the key issue that has been addressed heretofore, and that is, does the use in the emergency vehicle statute of the term governmental immunity give rise to any reasonable doubt as to a statutory waiver? And the answer, I submit, is clearly no. It does not give rise to reasonable doubt, because when this section, subsection D of the emergency vehicle statute, was adopted in 1981, the Delaware case law used the term governmental immunity interchangeably, for the most part, with the term sovereign immunity. And there are no cases, no Delaware cases at that time or since that I could find, that refers to governmental immunity as referring only to agencies or political subdivisions exclusive of the state. And of course,
could I interrupt you at this point?
Your Honor.
I understand your argument about the meaning of the term governmental immunity, but if that argument is going to have strength to it, then you're going to have to tell me why the General Assembly didn't use the term sovereign immunity. You know, what is the difference? That let's assume for the moment that the term sovereign immunity was in there. Why would the General Assembly not have chosen that term?
Because often, Your Honor, the word sovereign immunity is a subset of the general category of immunity, and sometimes the cases and statutes refer to sovereign immunity as being the immunity of the state or sometimes the federal government, whereas, as a technical matter, often the term governmental immunity includes not only sovereign immunity, but also political subdivisions, such as the county and municipal agencies. And the authorized emergency vehicle statute clearly covers the waterfront. It covers state, federal, county, and municipal entities, and it was clearer to use the term governmental immunity as the all-encompassing word rather than sovereign immunity, which is sometimes limited to the state's constitutional immunity.
So you're saying that if the term sovereign immunity had been in this statute, it would leave a question as to whether it applied to a municipality or another governmental unit?
Yes, possibly that could be the case. Or the problem might have been that there would have been a question, as Your Honor says, as to the scope of the term of the immunity.
Mr. Poole,
yes.
Let's assume all that is correct for the sake of argument, and that the opinion got it wrong when it looked to other states to define governmental immunity and missed the point that you've made this morning about subsection E. Isn't the real issue, though, how we can divine what the General Assembly intended in their entire scheme? Did they intend to waive governmental immunity as you define it up to the point that insurance was available, or did they intend to say, in effect, that in the case of an accident caused by an emergency vehicle driven with gross negligence, that we are to ignore the statute that discusses insurance coverage and the applicability of state funds only up to the amount of insurance that's available for any single accident?
Your Honor, in the case law, in other contexts where a statute has been found to be a waiver of the state's immunity, the court has stated that unless the particular statute provides for a limitation of the waiver of immunity, it is a complete waiver. And I refer first to the Sant case again, where this court indicated that in light of our holding that the General Assembly waived immunity there in connection to the Solid Waste Authority, that the alternative argument based on 18 Delaware Code 6511, the insurance statute, the court did not even need to reach that. So the clear answer, I think, to Your Honor's question is that if it's a specific situation, such as with the emergency vehicle statute, that is a later act. It is a specific act that the limitations, there's no limitation of liability. There's no limitation on the immunity. And the insurance statute picks up every other situation where there isn't otherwise a waiver. And I think that is
that's a good lawyer-like response, and I think I understand it. What I'd like you to do is convince me that if we were to write an opinion that said that, that it wouldn't come as a shock to the General Assembly to find out that this statute had opened them up to unlimited liability, regardless of the extent to which insurance covered the accident.
Yeah, I don't think it would come as a shock for two reasons. One, this is a very narrow statute. It applies only in connection with emergency vehicles. And secondly, it was enacted at a time when, as Justice Christie said in Doe versus Cates, the insurance program had failed. At that time, in the 1970s, early 1980s, the Title 18 had never been funded. And so the court in Doe versus Cates recognized that there was no waiver at all based on that statute at that time. So the General Assembly enacted a narrow statute in the absence of any waiver at all based on the insurance statute in order to protect the public in view of the necessarily increased incidence of accidents attendant to emergency responses. 4106 itself gives certain privileges to the drivers of vehicles to disregard the rules of the road, to go through red lights, to exceed speed limits, and obviously there are going to be an increased incidence of collisions in that situation. So I think the General Assembly was very focused on a very narrow area and in the context of not having any other waiver to protect the public.
Well, does this come simply from reading the face of the statute, or do you have any legislative history or any commentary that suggests that at the time the statute was passed, they had in mind going beyond the limits of the insurance that was available?
The answer is no, I don't have any legislative history. As Your Honors are aware, legislative history is very hard to come by in this state, particularly going back to the 70s. The synopses often just simply repeat language of the statute. And so I know of no particular legislative history, and I've not been able to find any comments by legislators as of that time in the early 1980s. But the face of the statute, I think, is absolutely clear. There's no reasonable doubt. And I think it's a reasonable inference that the policy behind the statute was to protect members of the public who are exposed to emergency vehicle responses.
I know this is kind of a tough one, but it's been over 20 years. Have you been able to determine whether anybody else has been unfortunate enough to have been in an accident with an emergency vehicle? What happened?
I have tried to research that, Your Honor, and I'm sure there have been accidents, but it apparently no such emergency vehicle accidents have resulted in litigation that have resulted in any reported opinions or even unreported opinions at the trial level or by this court. So this is a matter of first impression as far as I have been able to research. There was a discussion at one of the previous arguments that there was nothing in the record with respect to the fact that there was an increased incidence of, or there is an increased incidence of accidents resulting from emergency vehicle responses, and so there was some challenge as to whether the inference that I have submitted as to the purpose of the statute really had underlying validity. And I just call Your Honor's attention to findings to that effect in the trial court. And also, David Johnston was an expert on alarm systems and responses to alarms that was jointly retained by the state and by plaintiffs. And he submitted an expert opinion that, yes, emergency responses do cause an increased incidence of accidents, and that's why alarms are such a difficult problem. And he referred to actually a report of the International Association of Chiefs of Police, and there that report indicated that it's well known that false alarms increase the risk of accidents. I just referred to the appendix to the plaintiff's opening brief at A258. If Your Honors have no further questions with respect to the emergency vehicle statute, I'd like to turn to the issue of the appeal vis-a-vis London Fog.
I do have one question, and I'm backtracking a bit, but my question here is how the two sentences of subsection D fit together. The first sentence of subsection D, if I read it correctly, appears to say that the driver of an emergency vehicle is not liable for damages unless that driver was guilty of conduct amounting to gross negligence or willful or wanton negligence, correct?
Yes, yes.
Then the next sentence goes on to talk about the defense that can or can't be asserted by the owner of an emergency vehicle.
Right.
That sentence refers to actions on account of any damage to or loss of property on account of personal injury or death caused by the negligent or wrongful act of omission of the driver.
Right.
That is an act for which the driver would not be liable.
That's correct.
So I gather that the second sentence is designed to cover a claim against the state based on respondeat superior.
Both respondeat superior not requiring gross negligence, that's right, just ordinary negligence, or, and it's key here, Your Honor, it says of such driver or owner. And so it's not just respondeat superior, it's also the owner's independent ordinary negligence, such as improper supervision or improper training, and that is part of the issues that we presented on summary judgment in the trial court.
What about a situation where the driver has committed an act amounting to gross negligence and the claim is made against the state as owner on a theory of respondeat superior only?
Then, Your Honor, I'll briefly touch on the gross negligence issue at the end of my argument, but assuming, contrary to our position, that the driver was found by a jury to be only ordinarily negligent and therefore not liable because of the requirement of gross negligence here, and also, by the way, in the State Tort Claims Act, which requires gross negligence, then the driver would not be able to be held liable. But the owner would be, because the standard is different with respect to the owner in the statute compared to the driver. And there is case law, I don't have it at my fingertips, that respondeat superior can work, I think it was a Judge Ridgely opinion, and hold the principal liable, even though the agent cannot be held liable because of a different standard of liability that's required.
No, but my question is, suppose the agent, in this case the driver, is guilty of conduct amounting to gross negligence for which the driver would be liable.
Right. Okay, in that case, then respondeat superior clearly would make the state liable as well. But my point is that gross negligence is not required for the state to be liable either on respondeat superior or independent.
I understand that, but in that case where the state would be liable under principles of respondeat superior, how does the waiver or non-waiver clause work?
There it works because the key is the immunity issue, and the owner is contemplated to be a governmental entity, and the governmental entity has certain immunity protections unless there's a waiver. So as to the owner as opposed to the driver, there had to be a specific provision in the statute that provided for waiver of the immunity in order for a claimant to be able to proceed against the owner as opposed to the driver. The driver does not have the same protections of immunity that the state has or that a county has or a municipality has or a governmental entity has, because if the driver acts outside the discretionary public function area or is a lower level person, it does not enjoy the protection of immunity that is otherwise afforded to the entity of the state. So that's why the statute is set up this way. As to London Fog, Your Honors, the issues have to be viewed in the light most favorable to the appellants as the non-moving parties on summary judgment below, and they are all intensely factual disputes that must be resolved by a jury. It should not have been resolved as a matter of law on summary judgment against the plaintiffs. Those are duty, foreseeability, negligence, and proximate cause. In two 1988 opinions, this court held that breach of duty is a jury issue, the Naidu versus Laird case, and the Diassi versus Moroni case. Actually, London Fog, in its answering brief, cited another case at page 21 called Dufilly versus Delaware Electric Cooperative, and Your Honors are probably familiar with that case because of recent citations and discussions of that case. And there, the court made it very clear that issues of proximate cause and supervening cause are fact-driven.
Mr. Poole, you're well into your rebuttal time. Do you want to use it or do you want to save it? I know you want to get to the gross negligence issue.
Yeah, I think I will use part of it, Your Honor.
All right.
Let me tell the court a little bit about the facts here. It was an exclusive alarm by alarm system by London Fog. It was not the outlets. It was not anybody else. It was exclusively in the control of London Fog. And as I indicated in a prior argument, but for the activation of this alarm, this collision would never have happened. London Fog tries to blame the ocean outlets, the shopping center, for activating the alarm. But London Fog never disclosed to the outlets that washing the sidewalk and spray hitting their building would cause the alarm to activate, even though there was no attempted entry into the London Fog store. So there was no attempt by London Fog to disclose that this was a very sensitive, maybe overly sensitive, alarm system. And it's very foreseeable, as the court below said at one point, that those responding to a false alarm because of the not having access, having the privilege of not being restricted by the rules of the road, speed limits, red lights, and so forth, that there would be an accident. The court said that that was foreseeable in denying summary judgment to the outlets. And we submit that the London Fog issue and the outlets issue is the same thing. London Fog is just one of the stores in the outlets complex. And so the really excellent, well-reasoned opinion of the trial court denying summary judgment to the outlets should be equally applicable to the London Fog. And London Fog had a call list to try to verify the alarms, have people available, but all three persons on that call list on the day of the collision were not available. And so there could be no discussion. There was nothing in advance. There was no protocol between London Fog and the outlets, no cell phone connections to be able to deal with a situation where, as London Fog says, ocean outlets' carelessness may have caused the alarm to activate. If there had been this protocol set up in advance, the communication could have happened in a minute or two, and this collision would never have occurred because the testimony was undisputed that if notified that it wasn't a real emergency, the police would not have responded by going too fast or going through red lights. So these are issues of negligence that certainly should be for the jury to resolve, not on the, on summary judgment. One of the, Your Honor, I think it was Justice Holland asked whether the court below found supervening or intervening, superseding or intervening cause. And as I went back and looked at the opinions, it's clear that the court did not find superseding cause with respect to the outlets because of the foreseeability of this kind of an accident. And we again submit that the same should apply to London Fog. With my time almost out, I just want to say as to gross negligence that this was thoroughly briefed. Mr. Ballinger argued gross negligence at the prior two arguments. And again, the facts must be viewed most favorably to the appellants as the non-moving party on summary judgment. Gross negligence is a jury issue. The best definition of gross negligence is Jardell versus Hughes, 1987 opinion of this court that talks about the continuum between ordinary negligence, gross negligence, and the more strict standard of criminal or wanton and wanton disregard. And the two fact patterns that are very similar, where the court said that even wanton disregard is a jury issue, are Green versus Millsboro Fire and Wilson versus Tweed. So for all those reasons, Your Honors, appellants, I respectfully submit that the summary judgments in favor of the state and London Fog should be reversed and the case remanded for trial before a jury.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Seitz, I guess you go first.
Your Honor, I've reserved 10 minutes. May it please the court. Good morning, Justice. George Seitz for the State of Delaware, the Department of Public Safety, and the Division of State Police. I've reserved 10 minutes for this argument. This court correctly ruled that the plain language of the emergency vehicle statute suggests that the General Assembly did not intend that statute to operate as a complete waiver of the state's sovereign immunity. Sovereign immunity and governmental immunity are distinct terms, and decisions in this court and the use of those terms in the statutes, as well as in other Supreme Court decisions from other states, support that finding.
There may be distinct, but as I hear Mr. Poole's argument, the genus is governmental and the species is sovereign, and sovereign is included within governmental. What's your answer to that?
I don't believe there is any case law to that effect that he cited. I don't believe, I think it's the principle that he's expounding, but I don't believe it's backed up by the cases. I don't believe, he says that the term sovereign immunity had been used in the statute, there'd be a question about whether the counties and other municipalities would be included. I submit that the use of the term governmental immunity raises the question of whether sovereign immunity is included.
Well, how about the argument that he focused on today regarding subsection E of section 4106 of Title 21, defining authorized emergency vehicles to include state and as well as subdivision vehicles?
Authorized emergency vehicles do include state vehicles, but I believe it's consistent with this court's opinion that by finding that governmental immunity does not include sovereign immunity, that the court could easily see the legislature was recognizing that at the time the statute was enacted, Section 6511 was already on the books. It provided a program for insurance, and it recognized that for state-owned vehicles, there was a waiver of sovereign immunity to the extent there is insurance provided. So to the extent there is insurance provided, the state cannot assert any immunity. There is a $1 million limit, and above that, the state-owned vehicles, and the state is protected by the doctrine of sovereign immunity. The state General Assembly has used sovereign immunity in a number of statutes when dealing with the state's liability reserved to the state. It has used the term governmental immunity only once in this statute. And the courts of the state have not ever addressed, up until this decision, the distinction between the term governmental and sovereign immunity. The plaintiffs point to the Pajewski case, and they say that the court there used the terms interchangeably. But I think if you take a close look at the Pajewski case, you'll see that the court was dealing with the liability reserved to the state. It referred to that as sovereign immunity, not governmental immunity. True, in one footnote, it used the term governmental immunity, but it was citing to a treatise, an Amjor treatise, where that term was used. And so the use of that term in one footnote does not really establish the point that the plaintiffs are trying to make. That Pajewski court was not addressing what is the distinction between governmental immunity and sovereign immunity and how should they be defined. It also cited to the Simon versus Held case because it was authored by then Judge Christie. I believe that they cited that because he wrote the Doe v. Cass decision. And I think, as I pointed out in our motion response, Judge Christie used the term purposely governmental immunity because he was not referring to sovereign immunity at all. In the Held case, the court was considering the individual liability of a police officer. The state was not even a defendant. The court pointed out that these are instances where the state should be sure that their police officers are protected by insurance because they are not protected from liability. They have individual liability for their acts. The this court, this issue was not addressed at all, as I said, until this court's decision in December, and I think the court got it right. I think the court was correct in finding sovereign immunity was reserved to the state. It was also correct, contrary to plaintiff's position, in noting that other state Supreme Courts have found them to be distinct terms. In the case of Ross v. Consumer Products, Anderson v. City of Milwaukee, and Schutman v. Department of Transportation, all noted in this court's December opinion, all discuss the term sovereign immunity and governmental immunity and how they're distinct. And the plaintiff has tried to argue that those cases were not appropriate to note, but I think the quotes are taken out of context. They refer to the use of term governmental immunity in other decisions or in footnotes that are just out of context. Each one of those cases addressed the question and I think squarely found that there are distinct terms.
Mr. Seitz, let's assume for the sake of this morning's argument that appellant has it right that subsection E resolves the issue of a distinction for this particular fact situation between governmental immunity and sovereign immunity. What is it about the statutory scheme generally that would allow us to say that the General Assembly, when they adopted 4106, did not have or did have the insurance program in mind and concluded that in the case of an accident caused by the gross negligence of the operator of a state emergency vehicle, that the state intended to waive sovereign immunity beyond the applicable insurance available? What is it about the statutory scheme that allows us to resolve that issue?
I believe, Your Honor, the statutory scheme is that the state wanted to ensure that individual officers would not be subjected to personal liability while they were doing their jobs and responding to an emergency. The intent of the statute was to ensure that an owner, be it a private owner, a county, a municipal, a fire department, could not come into court and say that since the officers were protected, they were also protected by governmental immunity. In a sense, it was a codification of the respondeat superior doctrine. It has also had to be, the court wanted to address the issue that was also part of the statutory scheme at the time it was adopted, that counties, municipalities, owners of vehicles were subjected to liability under Section 40411. They didn't have to be the employer or the fact that these people were their agents, they didn't even need to refer to the doctrine of respondeat superior because under the 4001, they were liable as the owner. That statute imposed liability on them for negligence that resulted from vehicles they owned. And I think that the plaintiff has come in and tried to insert into, hope that this court will insert a legislative finding that there was an intent to waive this complete state sovereign immunity. They point to things about the high incidence. They say there's an increased incidence of accidents with respect to emergency vehicle responses. And they report to findings of the court and their own experts. Well, those things were not part of the General Assembly's legislative history. There's no record that the General Assembly found that. The Doe v. Cass decision, if you will, the State versus Michigan, and the Ross decision, which this court noted, addressed 8 different factual scenarios. Some of them involved the state, some of them involved counties and municipalities. But in addressing sovereign immunity, that court talked about what the doctrine meant. And it found that although the concepts of sovereign immunity and governmental immunity are related, they are distinct terms and have origins and histories. Sovereign immunity and governmental immunity are not synonymous. True, they have been over the years used interchangeably in decisions, but a delineation may be helpful. Sovereign immunity is a specific term limited to the appellation to the state and to its departments. Governmental immunity is an immunity that is reserved to lower levels of government.
Well, and Mr. Seitz, is it your understanding of the statute that subsection D for everyone that this statute covers should be read to say, no one can assert the defense of governmental immunity to the extent they have insurance in any action? And that's what we should be reading into the statute. and that no matter whether you're the state or anyone else listed in E, what this statute says is should be construed as to the extent you have insurance.
I think that that's what the statute intended, and that's what how it's been followed in practice.
Mr. Poole told us there's no case that's construed 4106. Do you know of any case that's construed this emergency vehicle statute?
Well, I believe that we cited a case in the briefs submitted here that it was Newcastle County decision where the county, I see my time is up.
You can go ahead and answer the question.
The county came in and tried to use the statute just as I think the legislature had intended it might be used. Its employee was protected. The county said, therefore, that we're protected. And the court said, no, you can't do that. You do not have the right to use that governmental immunity given to the individual to protect yourself. So under the statutory scheme, to the extent the county had liability and was liable under the governmental statutes, the court found it to be would have to be in court and answer those claims.
What was insurance discussed in that case?
No, insurance was discussed in another case by Judge Del Pesco, which is also cited in the briefs, where she said she pointed to the statute. There was a question about how it should be interpreted, and she indicated that the obvious purpose of the statute was recognition that by state law, all motor vehicles are supposed to be are mandatorily required to have insurance, and therefore, that's obviously why the language was in the statute.
Thank you, Mr. Stein.
Thank you.
Mr. Chief Justice, Justice of the Supreme Court, may I comment a little bit about the statutory history of 4106D, because it's set forth in my answering brief and is one of my issues, in addition to gross negligence, if I could. With the court's permission. This is my April 7th, 2003 brief, and it's something that I've been tangentially involved with for a number of years. The 1954 code for 4106D provided the following. The foregoing provisions shall not relieve the driver of any of an authorized emergency vehicle from the duty to drive with due regard for the safety of all persons, nor shall such provision protect the driver from the consequences of his reckless disregard for the safety of others. End of section. No second sentence. But it was twofold. It did not protect the, or did not relieve the driver from the duty to drive with due regard for the safety of all persons. That's the negligence standard. Nor the gross negligence standard. Provisions reckless disregard, or you can even argue willful and wanton. Now, roll forward 20 years to July 3, 1974, a collision occurs between a fire truck operated by Willis A. Smith, Jr. and owned by the Millsboro Fire Company and a pickup truck operated by Willie C. Green. Mr. Green sues Mr. Smith, the driver of the fire truck, and the Millsboro Fire Company based upon a standard of negligence. The Superior Court in Green versus Millsboro Fire held that defendant Smith, the driver of the truck, was negligent. That's at 385 Atlantic 2nd, 135, 1978. It also holds that Mr. Green was contributory negligent, so they wiped themselves out. Mr. Green takes an appeal to this court, and Smith and the Millsboro Fire Company do not. This court reverses on the finding and says that there was a question of fact as to whether Mr. Green was contributory negligent that should have been presented to the jury. In the next full session of the Delaware General Assembly, Section 4106 was deleted in its entirety to eliminate liability for personal injury or death caused by the mere negligent or wrongful act of the driver of the emergency vehicle. And the second sentence was added in at that time. I think that's the legislative history, and what essentially the court will have to address is whether that in that context, and I submit to you that's the context leading up to the change, including the Superior Court decision, whether in that context there was an intent on the part of the General Assembly to waive immunity beyond insurance coverage, particularly at a time when they were eliminating immunity for the driver for negligent acts, but yet picking up that negligent act. Did they also intend to pick up the immunity to the extent that they were waiving beyond insurance coverage. And I think you'll find that set forth on pages 10 through 13 of my answering brief as a prelude to the argument I was making at that time, which was addressing the gross negligence standard in that context. I was counsel of record in Green, so I have a vivid recollection of most of those events at that time. On the issue of gross negligence, at the time we filed the response to the motion for re-argument, there was no substantive matter set forth in the motion for re-argument. We checked the cases cited in the briefs up until that point in time. We renewed that search as of this morning. There is no change in any Delaware cases, either on 4106 as to extended addresses or gross negligence on those issues at all, and therefore I'm content to rely not only on my answering brief on the appeal, but on the argument from May of 2003, which has been transcribed.
Excuse me, Mr. Weiner. Didn't mean to cut off your sentence.
Sorry.
Mr. Poole argues that gross negligence is a jury question and relies in part on the decision of this court in Jardel. What's your answer to that?
In Jardel, this court said that on questions of willful and wantonness, the trial court should test those allegations to see if there is a credible case to be presented to the jury. In this case, the judge did that on each and every issue raised. We went through that in our answering brief. On the question, they argued on appeal that my client had to stop. Statute doesn't say stop. 4106 says slow or stop. There's no evidence that my client did not slow or stop in the record. The statute says exceed the speed limit. They don't argue the speed limit at all. There is no evidence in the record that my client exceeded the 35 mile per hour speed limit. The judge went through each and every one of those factors and found that there was no evidence to support their arguments. They rely upon Ms. Duchette, who did not see the accident, saw the driving at a spot, at a location hundreds of feet away, but did not see the accident herself. They rely upon Mr. DeJangi, who said 30 miles per hour. 30 miles per hour is less than 35 miles per hour. Statute speaks in terms of exceeding the speed limit. As I couldn't say it any better than Judge Vaughn did in his report to decision, or in his decision in this court. As the absence, he tested all the factors, he took all of their arguments, could not find any evidence to establish a tribal issue on any of those facts, and so held. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Mr. Collins.
Mr. Chief Justice, Justices of the Supreme Court, good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Kevin Connors, and I represent the appellee London Fog in this case. The issue that I was asked to address today by virtue of Mr. Poole's petition for re-argument / clarification was whether the liability of London Fog is basically a jury question. That issue has been thoroughly briefed and I believe thoroughly argued. I do want to highlight, and I also want to piggyback on what Mr. Weiner just said. Judge Vaughn did likewise with respect to my client in ruling upon London Fog's motion for summary judgment. He tested the issue of whether there was any basis for submitting this case to a jury. And under the facts and under the law, as the law pertains to duty, foreseeability, and proximate cause, Judge Vaughn reasonably concluded that summary judgment should be awarded to London Fog. Mr. Poole has asked this honorable court to look at the opinion of Judge Vaughn as it related to the outlet laws and conclude that the same decision should be reached as to my client, London Fog. But as our brief points out, and as I attempted to argue previously, the facts as they pertain to London Fog and to the outlet laws really were different. It was the outlet mall's employees who were on site, and it was an outlet mall employee who was power washing at the time. It was an outlet mall employee who knew or should have known that his power washing set this particular alarm off, It was the outlet malls that had many prior false alarms resulting in a police response. London Fog, to the contrary, had no prior police responses. At the last argument in May of 2003, Mr. Justice Holland asked me to advise the court what Mr. Poole was referring to when he said that there had been prior false alarms. In point of fact, what I explained to this honorable court then was that what happened was when London Fog employees opened or closed the store, they likely punched in the wrong code. That prompted a call from the alarm company right to the store. A code was given to the alarm company, and that was the end of it. There was one instance earlier in August where later on at night, in a situation where it was not the normal store closing time, that someone tried numerous times to set the alarm, and sometimes the right code was punched in, sometimes it wasn't. The alarm company called the police first and then called the store. The employee answered the phone and gave the right code. No police response ever resulted from that one prior act, and that's pointed out in our brief. So the Paulies are really abjectly incorrect when they say there were numerous instances of false alarms that required a police response. And I think that's important because the concept of duty based upon the law really, I think, requires an antecedent probability that a given act is going to occur because of something that you have forgotten to do. No Delaware cases have really addressed the concepts of duty and foreseeability in a false alarm situation. We had highlighted certain cases from other jurisdictions. I will not go into them in depth, but I do invite the court's attention to the Western Stone case and to the Gath case and the Vest cases. All of those stand for the proposition that the false alarm and the resulting harm that engendered, so to speak, were simply too attenuated under the law and under the facts of the case. What I think is very important is a proclamation from this honorable court in the McKeon case quite a number of years ago, and that is, if the remote cause did nothing more than furnish the occasion by which the injury was possible, that remote cause does not constitute the proximate cause. There were some instances, there were some cases that were brought up previously where the court said a false alarm might possibly be deemed to be the cause of the particular harm. But those two cases were really, really factually different. One involved a situation where folks were actually working on the alarm system and didn't see fit to tell the alarm company that they were doing so. Another situation was a situation in a bank where false alarms had resulted from customers apparently pushing a button located on a desk. And what is really unique about that case was that the same child who apparently pushed the alarm button, causing a response and an injury, had done the exact same thing just 6 days before. In those situations, you have knowledge, more direct knowledge on the part of the premises owner, and certainly more less attenuation than you do in the instant case. Mr. Poole brought up several cases which spoke in part to the issue of whether proximate cause and foreseeability are jury questions. It's certainly true that in some circumstances, under certain given sets of facts, that may well be true, but it is equally as true that the case law and precedent under which this honorable court operates
enables a trial judge to test the concepts of duty, proximate cause, and foreseeability against existing facts before that particular judge, and where you have a situation that falls under this honorable court's proclamation in the McKeon case, which I just read the most important holding from, that judge is well within his or her rights to withhold the case from the jury. In this particular case, the facts are just far too attenuated. London Fog, the store was not open at the time. It did have a protocol in place for the alarm company to call employees who were off-site. But at that point in time, even if London Fog's employees were to have been reached by ADT, the alarm company, the question then becomes, what are the London Fog employees to do? Some of them 10, 20, 30 miles away from the store. They certainly have no duty to come to the store to try to figure out whether there may be some intruder in the store. The outlet mall, the discovery in this case revealed that the outlet mall would never have allowed any of the outlet mall's individuals to have been on the protocol call list either. The company that was there, was then and there acting, was the outlet malls, and there's certainly no evidence that we knew, London Fog knew, that power washing caused our alarm to go off. That had never, ever come up before.
Thank you, Mr. Conner.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Poole, you virtually used up your rebuttal time, but would you like to request the court to grant you an extra minute?
Actually, I can only I only need 30 seconds, Your Honor.
Right.
I appreciate the indulgence. And that's just to simply correct one thing that Mr. Weiner said, and the trial court had inadvertently misunderstood the history of subsection D of the Emergency Vehicle Statute, and unfortunately, as a result of that, this court as well made the same error, and that is that it was subsection E that was amended in 1978 at the time of the Green versus Millsboro Fire Company decision. And subsection D, the one that is the key, was not amended until 1981. I just refer the court to the plaintiff's opening brief, docket 28 at page 14.
Thank you, Mr. Poole.
Thank you, Your Honor.
This difficult case has been well argued, and the court appreciates that. The court will take the case under advisement and take a recess.
Please rise.